Mr. Fry, your 2 o'clock magician is here.
Believe it or not, I have more important things to do today than laugh and clap my hands. Reschedule.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas.
Hello and welcome back to Sound, Sight, Mind, the podcast where three brothers discuss classic episodes of The Twilight Zone three at a time. I'm Chris Andrade, and with me, as always, are my brothers Steve.
Hey.
And Ken.
Hello.
And it's been a while, but we're taking a look tonight at three episodes centered around a common theme, and we're calling it That Old Black Magic. Three tales of the supernatural, of curses, of enchantments. First episode we're going to take a look at is one of the hour-long episodes from the infamous Season 4, the season of hour-long episodes. And this is from one of Ken's favorite Twilight Zone writers, Earl Hamner Jr.
Hall of Famer.
Come on, not all his stuff was uniformly terrible.
Nah, he had one or two in there that were some gems. They're just not the ones that stick out to me.
And he really made a name for himself writing and producing The Waltons. You know, the story of Appalachian family and love and relationships. So he's mining some of that same territory here. Folksy, yes. Down-home romance among the simple folk who occasionally go to witches and turn into cats and things like that. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. The episode Jess Bell originally season 4 episode 7 originally aired February 14th 1963. Aww. Lovely little Valentine's Day love story.
Sweet.
Written by Earl Hamner Jr., directed by Buzz Kulik, music by Nathan Van Cleve. We've talked about him before. One of the unusual things about our episode tonight is that for a change, all three episodes we're going to discuss actually had music custom written for the episodes rather than resorting to stock music clips. Whether or not that makes them any better is up for debate. This stars Anne Francis, who we saw in The After Hours as a titular character, Jess Bell. James Best, who we discussed earlier in the episode, The Grave, as Billy Ben Turner. Laura Devon as Elwyn Ellie Glover. And Jeanette Nolan as Granny Hart, the witch. So the episode opens on a barn dance. Billy Ben Turner comes home, apparently, after being away a while, and gives a ring to Ellie Glover. They're kind of talking and you know, exchanging sweet nothings outside of this dance that's going on, and then they come back into the party where Ellie's father announces that the dance is an engagement party for his daughter, and Billy Ben and all the guests are very happy, with the notable exception of this dark-haired beauty in the back, Jess Bell. And she it's pretty obvious that she was not aware of this engagement and that she and Billy Ben have some kind of history there. So she leaves the party. And Ellie, either very naively or super passive-aggressively, sends Billy Ben after her and says, "Oh, Billy Ben, you should go tell Jess Bell to come back to the party." And he's going, "No, I really don't think I should, sweetheart." She's like, no, I'd be ever so upset if someone left my party early. So Billy Ben, not the sharpest tool in the shed, goes after Jess Bell to say, "Well, gee, I thought you'd like to wish us well." And she makes it clear that she has no intention of doing any such thing. And she recounts in some very flowery language their past relationship. And it's clearly hinted that they had a hot-blooded physical relationship. But she's kind of from a lower social class, and apparently it was kind of kept on the down low. And now here's Billy Ben getting married to the much more well-off Ellie. And she says she still loves him, and unless she warns him to tell his sweetheart not to go sewing her wedding dress just yet. Maybe she won't ever get married. And then we hear Rod Serling's opening narration.
The Twilight Zone has existed in many lands in many times. It has its roots in history and something that happened long, long ago and got told about and handed down from one generation of folk to the other. In the telling, the story gets added to and embroidered on, so that what might have happened in the time of the Druids is told as if it took place yesterday in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Such stories are best told by an elderly grandfather on a cold winter's night by the fireside in the southern hills of the Twilight Zone.
So what we see next is Jess Bell goes to this woman, Granny Hart. And when we come in on Granny's cabin there, she's looking in this kind of cracked mirror and apparently putting together some sort of potion, one ingredient of which appears to be graveyard dust. So right away we get the sense that this is not your nice, you know, harmless white magic, you know, folk healing stuff. And, you know, as she talks with Jess Bell, while Granny says, oh, no, she's not a witch. She has a power. But there's clearly some implications as Jess Bell's reviewing with her. Oh, but, you know, didn't this guy's cow die after he killed the hawk that was your pet? And, oh, and then you made a potion for the woman whose baby was sick. And you said, oh, and the baby lived. Yeah, but it had fits the rest of its life. And, oh, well, whatever, you know, kind of brushing it off, but eventually comes around to the fact that she wants something to make Billy Ben love her. And Granny tells her, well, she can do that, but the price is high. Jess Bell has no money. She offers up her pearl hairpin, and Granny seems interested until Jess Bell says, and the pin itself is pure silver, at which Granny recoils and says, take it out of my face. So then Jess Bell says she'll pay any price, at which point Granny gives her a potion to drink and says she'll eventually know what the price is at midnight. So apparently all this has happened just after she left the dance, because she goes back to the dance. They're still celebrating the engagement, except she walks up to Billy Ben. He takes one look at her, is suddenly struck, and walks and leaves with her in front of all the guests.
It's slightly awkward.
Yes. Just a bit. And yeah. And Ellie says outright, you know, when her parents are saying, well, what are you going to do? You know, and he says, oh, he won't be back. Jess Bell bewitched him. And then we cut to Billy and Jess Bell romancing in a field, rolling around in the grass there.
At least they had the decency not just start pounding each other on the
dance floor. Well, don't forget, this was a simpler time. You know, I have no doubt if they were to make it again today. Yeah. Jess Bell gets agitated and tries to leave when she realizes it's getting late. She doesn't know exactly what this curse is going to be, but she knows she has to get away. And she arrives home, kind of blows past her mom, goes, locks herself in a room, and as the clock strikes 12, she is transformed into a leopard. Because, of course she is.
Why not?
Obviously.
You know, you would have thought maybe a mountain lion, at least keep it local, but no, a leopard, and more on that later. Well, Billy shows up later, gives Jess Bell the ring he had originally given to Ellie, tells her he talked to the preacher, has set a wedding date, and then there's some exposition that shows that he's been trying to get Jess Bell to marry him ever since being bewitched, and she keeps pushing off the date because she knows that this is going to be a very difficult arrangement. they argue, and Jess Bell scratches his face. He has three claw marks. So she returns to Granny Hart, and in talking with her, you know, it's like, oh, actually, yeah, you are a witch after all. Go figure. And figures out that the price included her soul. And not only that, but she's now a witch herself and will be until she dies. And Granny advises her to go ahead and take what she bargained for. She paid the price. She might as well have the prize. Jess Bell is still conflicted and resisting marriage. And apparently she's spending every night stalking the countryside as a leopard. Billy Ben is a little bit troubled by her behavior. She's always running away and everything else, but is still under her spell. Eventually, she comes around and agrees to marriage. And then there's this great scene where she encounters Ellie picking flowers on the hillside. And talk about passive aggressive here. Yeah. Yes, but I was like, oh, yes, I thought I saw a patch of old maid's fern up on top of the mountain. And Ellie goes, oh, really? I see a lot of vixen wort here.
Did you see that nice patch of slut weed?
Right, exactly, yeah. So, you know, the claws are definitely coming out. And then Jespel says, you know, aren't you afraid being out here? I hear there's a wildcat been sighted in the area. And Ellie says, oh, but my father tells me that that cat will be dead by morning because he and all the other men, Billy Ben too, are going out on a hunting party that night to kill the cat. So Jespel is back home again, being fitted by her mom for her wedding dress. And in the process of doing that, lets it slip that she has been to see Granny Hart. And her mother figures out what's been going on and gets very distraught and, you know, says, what can I do to save you? She says, well, if you want me alive in the morning, you'll lock my door, you know, tonight. So she can't go out as a cat. Completely neglects the window. So, you know, after pounding on the door for a while, the cat figures, oh, wait a minute, I can just jump out the window. And goes out and sure enough is cornered by the hunting party and apparently killed. They Billy and a couple others fire their shotguns and the cat disappears in a cloud of smoke or vapor. And Billy finds the ring left behind that he had given her, and that's when he knows what's going on. The enchantment is immediately broken, and he sees Ellie outside, and right away they renew their commitment to each other. And this would be, you'd think, where the story would end, but hey, we've got an hour to fill, folks. So a year later, they're married, but Jespel's mother, who Billy goes to visit, It's amazing how cordial a relationship they have, given everything that apparently went on. But Jespel's mother warns Billy Ben that Jespel isn't dead. She just changes form. You can't kill a witch, and tells her how she appeared as a toad on her bed, and she tried to kill the toad with a broom, but, you know, she just vanished, and the toad weren't there. So sure enough, here at the wedding ceremony, there's a spider crawling on Ellie's veil, and Billy Ben reaches out to snatch it and crush it in his hand, and there's a little puff of flame from his hand, which was a neat little effect. But then shows up again when he takes his new bride home, and she says, I feel something evil here, and apparently that's the form of a white rat on the grandfather clock. Billy Ben tells her, stay here, gives her a Bible to hold, says, this will protect you, but stay here, goes running off to Granny Hart, who first comes on to him very weirdly, but
I thought seemed to be like, having... For a second, I was like, is this just a long game to get into Billy Ben's pants?
Yeah, she seemed to be having a lot of fun with this, but then says... You know, oh, so you want to know, you know, you want to know how to kill a witch. Well, that's expensive. So he pays her in coins, which must presumably be made of something other than silver, since, you know, she can't touch silver, but has no problem taking all these coins. And then gives him very specific instructions. He has to go home, make a figure of Jespel, dress it in Jespel's clothes, then run it through the heart with silver. So Billy goes home, finds Ellie outside, because, you know, it's Rod Serling's world, so women can't be trusted to follow even the simplest of directions. So she's outside and has been possessed by the spirit of Jespel, apparently. And so he gets past her. He has obtained Jespel's wedding dress from her mother, puts it on a dressmaker's mannequin, which apparently counts as a figure of making a figure of Jespel, stabs it through the heart, sort of, with the silver hat pin or hair pin, and then in kind of a Beetlejuice-esque moment, Jespel appears in the dress before vanishing. So it breaks, apparently breaks the curse, and Ellie and Billy Ben are out on the porch. Everything appears to be okay, and then they see a shooting star, and Ellie says Her mama always said that when you see a shooting star, it means a witch has just died.
Sad trombone sound with that line.
Yeah, little bit of a stretch there as far as the folk wisdom goes, but you know, this episode was not really long on subtlety. And this is unique, and this is the only episode in the original series not to have a closing narration from Rod Serling. Instead, it ends with a repetition of the first verse of the folk song that has been woven through this entire thing. In between a lot of the scenes, there's this original song, but it's written very much in the style of what they call one of the child ballads, one of these old folk tales of... you know, spurned lovers and enchantment and things like that. Very, you know, it's kind of plausible as an old folk ballad, but it's shoehorned in there. So this episode is
weird.
I don't know. It's it's a Twilight Zone. That kind of goes without saying. But it's you know, in reading different reviews and stuff, it seems like it's kind of a love it or hate it episode. A lot of people think it's one of the stronger ones of the hour longs, and it's another one where I think a really goofy script is saved by some really fine acting, with a possible exception of Billy Benn, who's playing the same character he always plays there. But Anne Francis as Jess Bell is great. She manages to bring some depth to a character that isn't written with a whole lot of depth. And Granny Hart there, Jeanette Nolan, just seems to be having an absolute blast playing that character. You know, looking at it through a modern lens, I mean, it's very much set up as, you know, Jess Bell being the woman who's, you know, he done her wrong. You know, it's very, very obvious in the beginning that Billy Benn kind of used her and unceremoniously dumped her. Even if she may be a little bit off kilter or whatever, you know, you kind of feel sorry for it. And yet there's no sympathy for her really anywhere in the story and the rest of the cast. I mean, her own mother is only too happy to help get rid of get rid of her spirit, and no one ever calls out Billy Benn on his bullshit either.
That's because Billy Benn was apparently the prize catch of Butthole County, wherever.
Yeah. I mean, this
place. Every female is just throwing herself.
Look at him. The guy's a smoke show. He's just just a stunning, stunning man.
But I mean, it's, you know, the whole thing and his whole he goes through this whole explanation about, well, yeah, but that was a different kind of love. You know, I ran hot with you and with her, it's slower.
Oh, she should have kicked him in the dick with that line. That was such a shitty thing to say.
That would have been the shortest hour long ever. Like 2 minutes in, kicking the dick. This has been the Twilight Zone.
Up yours, Billy Benn. Yeah, it's weird. There's some very effective scenes, and then there's stuff that's just not. Well, first of all, like I said, the leopard kind of comes out of nowhere. And I would have thought, like, oh, maybe they wanted a mountain lion and couldn't get one. And I had read something along those lines somewhere. Well, eventually they said, you know, they had wanted to get a black panther to match Jess Bell's black hair, but couldn't get one. But apparently Earl Hamner originally wrote a tiger. Because that made sense, too. Then when they called the animal agency, I guess, that the studio was using, he's like, the guy said, I'm up to my neck in tigers, but none of them can act. So he said, you'd have an easier time with this leopard here, except they had to keep the leopard so drugged to keep it docile. No.
You can kind of tell there's a scene where Jess Bell is transformed to the leopard and Billy Benn goes out looking.
Where he's hanging out on the roof?
Yeah. First of all, his peripherals are shit because he doesn't see a leopard on the roof just like right above his eye level. But like,
oh, yeah, when just, Billy walks out of the house.
It's just hanging out, just like, I'm chill, whatever, I'm a leopard, etc. Felt bad for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that shot when he comes out of the house, I thought that was a comp shot for a second because I'm like, he's awfully close to that leopard.
That's
and
why.
Even no, like a well-trained leopard. They just shot it full of Benadryl.
I don't know what they gave the leopard, but that leopard was stoned out of its mind the entire shoot. They said the hardest part about filming this episode was that the leopard kept falling asleep when it was supposed to be menacing.
This one's kind of weird because it doesn't. I mean, first of all the ones we're going to talk about in this podcast, I feel are a little odd because there's something a little cheap about just using like, oh, it's magic as a plot device when it comes to Twilight Zone, because there's so many great episodes that are, you know, blurring the gap between what's supernatural, what's, you know, psychological, what's, you know, what's science fiction. And just there's something about this that feels a little bit more juvenile.
Right.
It feels a little bit more like one of those like cheapy horror movies. And I found myself at some parts like watching it as if I was watching like an episode of Mystery Science Theater. Some of those just old bad horror movies, especially Jess Bell's mom. Her delivery is how you say a little over the
not
top.
Not subtle.
First of all, when she's like, "Get down on your knees and pray with me, Jess Bell," and then later on when she's talking about swatting the toad, is like, "I struck that toad with my broom." And it just, and then like when the rat's on the clock, all I can think of is like, hey, check me out. I'm doing my Hickory Dickory Dock impression.
Right. Yeah. That was, and then it pulls
like,
the clock
down
somehow. It was a very
Why didn't
heavy
you anchor
rat.
This thing? So yeah, it's weird. It feels very un-Twilight Zone-y to me because there is not as much of that, ambiguous nature.
Well, and speaking of ambiguity, I mean, the name Jess Bell, the whole thing is supposed to be reminiscent of Jezebel, and they even kind of slur it that way, sometimes Jess Bell. And it's setting her up as the villainess right away. And again, it's kind of a thin pretext. Yes, she goes to the witch. That was a bad idea. But they also make it clear she really didn't quite know what she was getting into. And she genuinely thought she loved the guy and he had treated her horribly and all that. But right away it's like, nope, she's the bad one. She's the one who's got to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there is that. I got to say that, you know, her character is a little bit more shades of gray than just black and white.
Right.
Well, when she said the only like menacing thing she does early on is when she says, tell her not to make the wedding dress because you guys aren't married yet.
Right.
That's a little threatening. But otherwise, I'm team Jess Bell all the way. I mean,
well, that's because you got a thing for Anne Francis.
I do. I think I do. And and here she's like country goth dream girl, like a cosplay kind of thing where it's like
I'm Anne Francis, but I'm naughty.
And you know she puts out. So
Yeah, I think she's like super adorable and sweet, and it's like he's just going for Ellie, who's just kind of
She's so vanilla. She's white bread.
Yeah,
white bread mayonnaise sandwich.
weird episode though. I'd seen it before, but I forgot it clearly. So when she turns into the leopard for the first time, I was like, what the hell?
I actually rewound it back to when she was first talking with Granny Hart. Because I'm like, did I miss something? I must have missed a setup.
Right.
Because like, is this cat people that I like suddenly go into a Val Luton movie? But no, it was weird.
Looking like Brave for the little cat statue.
Yeah.
The cabin is a giveaway.
Yeah, it is a little odd.
The folk song woven through is very bizarre too. It's kind of like the Living Man Owl Creek Bridge song, where it just kind of feels out of place for Twilight Zone.
Well, apparently Earl Hamner was proud of that, and apparently he also wrote this in record time. This was like written over the weekend.
Yeah, I guess another script had been rejected and they called him in or something like that.
And they needed something like right away to shoot. So that might account for some of the weird transitions and rough edges. It's just like there was not time to give the script another pass. But yeah. I will say my favorite bits of this episode, not unintentionally humorous, but my favorite bits were the Granny Hart bits.
Mm-hmm.
I love each time that she's introduced. She looks very sinister. Her hair is always like cascading into her face and like straggling over her eyes, and she's always like doing something sinister, looking over the fire.
It's very Shakespearean witch kind of
but
thing.
But the next shot is always she looks just like somebody's like pleasantly, you know, happy grandmother or something, you know.
Yeah,
like,
and that first scene she takes her cloak off and then just kind of fixes her hair, and all of a sudden she just looks like
I thought that was neat. I thought the second time we see her, when she's stirring something in a pot and looking very Macbeth, then it's revealed she's just doing laundry. It's just like the like her clothes in there. I do think it's really funny when she tries going after Billy Ben.
Yeah.
Like I said, like, is this the whole plan from the beginning? Like, Jess Bell's just like, finally I can get Billy Ben. Everybody else has gotten him. Why not me? But yeah, I like those bits. And like you said, Jeanette Nolan was clearly having fun with that.
I really like the scene when Billy Ben is coming back to the house and Ellie's outside and she's possessed by Jess Bell.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got Jess Bell's voice saying like, I'll never leave or something like that. There's a very like Evil Dead quality to that scene. And he runs back in the cabin and slams the door.
Did
and
you
I think
want
she's,
him to
like,
say
pounding on the door.
Tool shed and grab a chainsaw.
It was cool though. A little bit of like genuinely unsettling kind of horror moment to the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a lot scarier to have somebody possessed than it is to just see a mouse on a clock.
Yeah.
And point out that Jeanette Nolan was a 4-time Emmy nominee. She has a ton of TV roles and things. I mean, a lot of the Twilight Zone cast, a lot of these people had done a bunch of Westerns, anthologies, recurring roles on various shows. But Jeanette Nolan was actually a pretty well-respected actress.
Good for her. Good for her.
Good for her.
Team Anne Francis.
But again, I think Anne Francis gives the character much more depth than is even written into her. It's one where this could have been a real slog of an hour episode, but at least it keeps your interest. It holds your interest because the acting is pretty good, because you do get a little bit invested in the characters and you're willing to overlook the many ridiculous elements. Let's see, any more thoughts on that?
No.
Okay, so we will go from the vixen wort and slutweed strewn hillsides of the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Looks like someone's laying in a patch of bitch clover. If I were to recast it, because I felt like everyone had sort of like a modern face or image to them.
Right.
I think you could do a really effective shot for shot remake where Billy Ben is Will Forte. Jess Bell is Haley Steinfeld. Just look at a side-by-side comparison there. And Ellie is Sarah Chalky, who is the second Becky in Roseanne. Just Google image search all these side-by-side, and you'll agree with me. I think it's a pretty solid casting. All right, I'm good. We can move on now.
So we move from the sarcastic flora of the Blue Ridge Mountains to a scene of a Civil War battlefield. And we're going to look at the episode Still Valley. This was season 3, episode 11. Original air date was November 24th, 1961. It was written by Rod Serling, the screenplay that is, adapted from a short story called The Valley Was Still by Manly Wade Wellman. That's his name.
Manly?
It's not a descriptor.
Manly Wade Wellman. He wrote a lot of awesome stories, all set kind of in the South and the Midwest.
In fact, he won a literary award over William Faulkner, which William Faulkner was really, really pissed about. But yes, Manly Wade Wellman. I don't know if it later inspired Savage Steve Holland or anything like that, but it's a great name to go with. It was directed by James Sheldon, who had all kinds of TV directing credits from the Adam West Batman to The Equalizer. Featured music for this, again, original score was by a guy named Wilbur Hatch, who is the director of music and conductor for the Desi Arnaz Orchestra on I Love Lucy, and later became the music director for Desi Lu Studios, including work on Star Trek. The scene opens, it stars Gary Merrill as John Paradine, and Ben Cooper as Dogger, and then Vaughn Taylor, who we'd seen before as the salesman in I Sing the Body Electric, and the boss in Time Enough at Last. He plays Old Man Teague in this. So let's listen to Rod Serling's opening narration.
The time is 1863, the place the state of Virginia. The event is a mass bloodletting known as the Civil War. A tragic moment in time when a nation was split into two fragments, each fragment deeming itself a nation.
And then there's some more dialogue between Paradine and Dogger. And then Serling continues.
This is Joseph Paradine, Confederate cavalry, as he heads down toward a small town in the middle of a valley. But very shortly, Joseph Paradine will make contact with the enemy. He will also make contact with an outpost not found on a military map. An outpost called the Twilight Zone.
So the episode opens, and we see John Paradine, who seems to be an officer, the lower officer in the Confederate Army, and a soldier, Dogger. And the two of them are talking. Dogger appears to be expressing quite a bit of cowardice. He's unwilling to go and go scouting and display some of the most unconvincing shaking ever committed to film when he's handed a cup.
Wait till his hand is in frame and start shaking.
Yeah, but in any case, so John Paradine is saying, well, we need to go and scout over that ridge. Well, if you won't do it, I will. And it's clear that their unit is not doing well. They've scavenged clothes off Union troops. They're dirty and disheveled and generally a mess. And so they go, and he goes over this ridge where they understood that Union troops were to be mustering, and goes down. It's absolutely quiet, absolutely still. And he can't quite understand. He goes into town, and then he sees that there's tons of Union troops there, but they all appear to be frozen in place. And their eyes are open, but they're not moving. They're not active. They don't respond to anything. Some of them appear to be kind of frozen in mid-action, lifting up a barrel, bringing a horse over, and he can't quite figure out what's going on. And as he's going, examining a supply wagon and marveling at his good fortune, because the Union troops come bearing all the supplies that the Confederates are running short on right now, when he's startled by a flower pot getting knocked off a window. And he goes to take cover, and out comes this old guy with a beard who tells him that he did this, that he's the one responsible for putting all these guys to sleep. He says, with this book, he holds up this old, kind of large, flat, leather-bound book that says in a very 1960s font on the front, witchcraft. And he says, what are you talking about, witchcraft? He says, there must be some natural explanation for this. And the guy laughs. He says, well, I'll show you, and puts him under a spell. And he says, it was hypnotism. He says, oh, that wasn't hypnotism. He says, that was conjuring stuff. He says, I'm a witch, man, and my father was a witch man, a seventh son of a seventh son, I'm his seventh son, and I'm telling you, I could stop the whole Union Army, I could run a path up to Washington so that Bobby Lee could go in with three men and take over the whole country. He says, well, why don't you? He says, well, for one reason. He says, I'm dying, so someone else needs to take it over. So Paradine is interested, but realizes that the book, the incantations in the book are in the name of the Prince of Darkness, and feels kind of uneasy about that, but takes the book back, and apparently on the way tests it out on another Union battalion. So he gets back to camp holding this book and tells his commanding officer that, you know, what he's done, and the commanding officer says, tell you what, you're really tired. Why don't you go to bed and give me a report in the morning, because this is crazy. And then another scout comes back and says he just saw this frozen troop on the hill that was the one that Paradine says he just did. So they agree that this book could be the one thing that saves the Confederacy, and they agree, but he realizes that to read out this book out loud, not only are you invoking the name of the Prince of Darkness, but you're revoking the name of God, and that he can't do it, and if the Confederacy is going to die, at least it'll be buried in hallowed ground. Throws the book into the fire, and then we hear Rod Serling's closing narration.
On the following morning, Sergeant Paradine and the rest of these men were moved up north to a little town in Pennsylvania, an obscure little place where a battle was brewing, a town called Gettysburg. And this one was fought without the help of the devil. Small historical note not to be found in any known books, but part of the records in the Twilight Zone.
So this episode, it's fairly cut and dried by Twilight Zone standards. I wouldn't say there's really a twist at all. You know, right away we're again into the weird supernatural stuff. The magic is laid right out there. The guy just says, you know, I'm a witch man, and my father was a witch man, and okay, we just go with that.
And the book says in bold 36-point type, witchcraft.
Yeah, and something that would not have looked out of place at all on a title card for Bewitched. It's that kind of, you know, curvy letters with slanted tops. What really struck me with this one was how inferior this was to the source material. Mm-hmm. There are some places online where you can find the original story, The Valley Was Still, that was printed in various pulp magazines.
Yeah, and the biggest difference, I think, is that in the original story, it's all Joseph Paradine. It's told through his view, and the setup is mostly the same, going into the town, seeing the soldiers. But you get a lot more of his internal thoughts, which obviously are harder to do when it's, you know, television and you're not privy to the printed word. And Manly Wade Wellman in his story, I just like saying Manly Wade Wellman. I'll just keep saying it. Manly Wade Wellman in his story, like, says several times how Paradine had a streak of, like, I think he calls it, like, a romantic chivalry.
Yes.
He really believes in the cause of the South, and also, like, the...
Calls him a chivalric idealist.
Yes. And so, you know, a man of honor and everything that comes with it. And it's his internal struggle when he's talking with Teague about the use of the witchcraft. And the best thing in the book that is not included is when Teague presses him, Paradine, to join with him because he needs a military man to help
right.
him.
Right, it's not that Teague's dying. He says
he wants a military man to figure out
the army stuff.
Yeah, and plus Teague wants to set himself up as the new King of America or president or whatever he wants to become.
Well, and the other interesting thing is that Teague's book, it is not labeled witchcraft. It's the powwows of some name or other.
Right.
But the incantations in the book, what really disturbs Paradine in the short story is that he gets a look at the book and he says, you've made some edits here. Because the incantations in the book, everything was invoked in the name of God and the name of Jesus.
It was very white magic, and then Teague
transformed
it.
Crossed it out and wrote in Satan. and said, yeah, that you can. He says, well, some of them don't. He says, and it worked for a lot of this stuff, but for the cursing and the reversals and things like you see here, you need to call on someone else who's listening too.
And then he wants Paradine to, if he's going to join with him, he needs to sign in blood on the book, which is always a good option.
Right.
And then Paradine whips out his saber, which had been pointed out beforehand that he had sharpened to razor honed, and proceeds to slice Teague's head off
in graphic right detail, who like feels the resistance of the bone, geez. And then he doesn't.
And then there's a moment of Teague looking at him surprisingly before his head tumbled down. And so it's all him, and it's all his choice. Whereas in Rod Serling's teleplay, first of all, the character becomes wishy-washy because he says he tried out a spell already on another
right.
Union Patrol. So it's like you've already allied yourself with Satan if you actually have done that.
Right.
And then he just seems to have like a sudden change of heart, you know? I thought when I was watching it before I reread the story, because I'd read the story a long time ago, when I was watching it, I thought it was really odd that Serling didn't write for Paradigm and what was his
Dogger,
Taylor Soldier's name, Dogger. It was really odd that he did not write for both of them to go down to investigate, because that would have given
a natural
back and forth, and then Dogger had been established as cowardly and willing to do that, willing to use the black magic, and it would have really cemented Paradigm's character as somebody who is, you know, more good. It's just kind of a very imperfect adaptation.
Yeah, I didn't like it. I didn't read the original story. That sounds way cooler. But anything with
decapitation is automatically
cooler. I know. I don't know what I was expecting, but when it ended, I was taken by surprise. I was like, oh, that's it. Okay. It seemed like a lot to get to like a cute little moment of, oh, hallowed ground going to Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. All right. And then also it's like, I guess if the source material is romanticizing his character as being this chivalrous person, but it's hard when the whole thing is from the point of view of this very romantic South notion, which I think, you know, the bubble's kind of been burst on that kind of idea of, the Southern genteel Confederacy.
Yeah.
When things were simpler and we owned people. So when he's talking about, like, when he says, like, if this cause is going to die, I want it to die on hallowed ground. It's like, the cause of slavery? It's just kind of a tricky one to side with anybody.
Well, one of the interesting things in the short story, too, the implication in the Serling adaptation is that they die at Gettysburg. You know, it was such a bloody battle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's explicitly told in the story that Paradigm lives and used to say that the battle was not lost, you know, the war was not lost at Gettysburg or Antietam, but in this little town where he, made this decision.
Hmm.
And I'm kind of surprised that given Serling's history with addressing, you know, the nuclear threat and things like that, that he didn't see the allegory potential in this. The idea of, you know, victory, but at what cost?
Right.
You know, it's like, boy, you really could have, if you wanted to contemporize this and draw some parallels, there was a lot you could have done with this to make it really kind of hard-hitting. And just seems like a missed opportunity.
Because it doesn't have any of that added depth or nuance, or, you know, even like keeping the focus that the original story does, it definitely becomes a kind of an also-ran episode. It's just yet another one in a string of war stories.
Yeah, it's not horrible, but...
Did have a lot of,
Yeah, it's just like, thematic, the thematic elements are sort of seem to be like driving past each other in the opposite direction. Because like you said, there is a great chance to kind of explore this idea of if you're aligning with evil, if you're aligning with like dark forces to win something in the context of something like the Civil War, there's probably some interesting places to go. But when you're really kind of micro-focusing the story on one man's sort of personal moral struggle, it's tough to make it all work.
I even thought it would have been more interesting had Paradigm gone, because again, he says that he tried out the book, which I think is a big misstep and totally takes away from the whole plot device. But even if that had happened, I thought it might have even been a stronger story if his commanding officer had been the one to throw it into the fire. And even though like we don't know anything about this character, it would just, you know, I don't know, it would have felt a little bit more pure.
Right.
Because as it was, it just felt kind of wishy-washy.
Yeah, because the commanding officer was just like delivering everything with the same, all his lines were the same kind of gruff, stoic commanding delivery, so he's mm-hmm. like,
had a great mustache though. So
had an awesome mustache.
That's
but...
what you needed to command an army in the Civil yeah. Wars. You needed good facial hair.
That's right.
That's why if we have another Civil War now, we're going to look to the hipsters to lead us because the beards are just fantastic.
That's right. yeah, he was very much like, you know, officer, I order you to go to bed, and then 5 minutes later. Well, if that's the only way that we can win, then that's the way we're going to win. It was just like no change in emotion to him saying, like, that's hogwash. Okay, we're doing the magic now.
Yeah.
That was a quick cast. It was like, we just need somebody to look good in a mustache. Yeah. And also, it's kind of a repeat, not only of just basic kind of like war story things, but the effect of people frozen standing still. We had seen it done much more effectively and much more interestingly in Elegy.
Mm-hmm.
And here it was just like, eh, you know, people standing still, not a big deal.
Right.
So, yeah. Okay. Not one of my favorites.
Nah. No, this of the three, this was probably the weakest one. And again, it wasn't that it was horrible. It was just, it was there. It was fine. And we're going to close with a last season episode, Queen of the Nile. This was season 5, episode 23, originally aired March 6, 1964, directed by John Brahm, who did quite a lot of things, including the Vincent Price vehicle, The Mad Magician. And it's appropriate because this this kind of veers into the straight-up horror movie territory. In some ways, it was the writing was credited at the time to Charles Beaumont, but it was actually ghostwritten by Jerry Soule. This is when Charles Beaumont was quite ill, and other writers were covering him for. So,
yeah, I believe Charles Beaumont and Jerry Soule brainstormed the idea and came up with it, and then Jerry Soule was the one to actually do the writing.
Gotcha. And featured music here was by Lucien Morawek. Not 100% sure on that pronunciation. He was actually a French jazz pianist and was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Score for his work on The Man in the Iron Mask. But he did original music for this, and you can hear some of that kind of Hollywood jazz influence there. Episode stars Anne Blythe as Pamela Morris. Lee Phillips as journalist Jordan Herrick. A nice turn by Celia Lovsky as Viola Draper. And then Herrick's editor Kruger is played by Frank Ferguson. So columnist Jordan Herrick is visiting this actress, Pamela Morris, kind of this, you know, glamorous starlet. He gets there and she's swimming in the pool and comes out with kind of the beauty queen look of the day, which just, you know, here looks like plastered on a lot of makeup. And, you know,
a nice helmet of hair.
Yes, like quite the helmet of hair.
And if you don't want any hair to move at all.
After he first sees her and he's preparing for the interview, we hear Rod Serling's opening narration.
Jordan Herrick, syndicated columnist whose work appears in more than 100 newspapers. By nature a cynic, a disbeliever, caught for the moment by a lovely vision. He knows the vision he's seen is no dream. She is Pamela Morris, renowned movie star, whose name is a household word and whose face is known to millions. What Mr. Herrick does not know is that he has also just looked into the face of the Twilight Zone.
And her estate seems to be decorated with a lot of Egyptian motif kind of things. And She's very flirtatious, and he notices when he goes in, he's waiting for the interview. He sees this picture of her that's dated 1940, and looks about like she looks right now, which strikes him as odd. And he asks her straight out, you know, how old is she? And she, you know, kind of does that Hollywood starlet, oh, you know, aren't you forward and direct, and how old do you think I am? He says, well, you don't look a day older than you did in that picture there. And she says, she gets a little bit flustered, but then says, oh, well, that was painted. That was the man's genius. I was a mere child, and he projected what would be the blossoming of my beauty as an adult, and kind of plays it off as that. But then he starts running down kind of her production history from his notes, and there are a couple kind of incongruous things about dates and times and things, and she's like, oh, well, those are just mistakes. Obviously, I couldn't have been in a movie back then. I was far too young. I don't even think I'd seen a movie at this point. Meantime, this old woman, Viola Draper, who is supposedly Pamela Morris's mother, is hanging around, and she's kind of perturbed at what her daughter is doing, and she's like, oh, you know, not another one, kind of thing. As she continues to flirt with him and winds up, you know, they wind up kissing the journalist and the movie star and making plans for a date. And the mother takes the journalist aside and says, you're not planning on seeing her again, are you? And he says, well, actually, yes, why? And he says, no, you shouldn't. You can't come back. And he says, why? And she says, you know, how old do you think she is? And I don't know. And singing, and the woman says, no, I'm not her mother. I'm her daughter. And trying to figure out what's going on there. And he eventually tells Pamela Morris, you know, your mother said she was your daughter. And Pamela Morris gives this whole story about how when her father died, her mother went crazy. And that's why she's very confused. And it's very sad. And he kind of buys that. But there's still signs that things are not quite what they appear. And he asks his editor to do some digging into some things. And his editor traces back then and finds that there was another actress who had done this film, Queen of the Nile, back then. And it was a remake of an old movie that Pamela Morris had done, and the actress looked just like her and had a similar backstory and all these things. And gradually, through some detective work, it becomes obvious that we're looking at some kind of like Picture of Dorian Gray type thing here or something. You know, there's she seems to have hung around for a long time and been ageless the whole time. So he eventually goes back, confronts her about it, and she says the secret is this scarab beetle. And she takes out this live beetle in a glass case and winds up putting it on his chest, and the beetle apparently drains the life force from him. And what for the time was a cool bit of special effects, he goes down to first kind of ages up and then to a skeleton and then crumbles into dust. And then she picks up the scarab and apparently is taking the life force from him. Then we hear the Rod Serling's closing narration.
Everybody knows Pamela Morris, the beautiful and eternally young movie star. Or does she have another name, even more famous? An Egyptian name from centuries past. It's best not to be too curious, lest you wind up like Jordan Herrick, a pile of dust and old clothing, discarded in the endless eternity of the Twilight Zone.
As I said, this episode is almost a straight-up horror episode, especially when you get to the for-the-time kind of graphic ending. It's fairly obvious what's going on from the beginning. It's kind of weird. There doesn't seem to be much in the way of a twist. It's telegraphed pretty early on. Mm-hmm. There is a nice little moment, you know, the phone call with the editor where they're kind of comparing notes. But you
that was a nice glimpse in what Google was like back then.
Well, that's the thing.
Some guy in an office, a tiny like 10x10 office, who just magically has file cabinets with all these movie stars' headshots.
Well, but you figure if you're an entertainment editor for a major newspaper or something like that, then you might, you know, going back to the files. But yeah, these days, this plot would just never fly. It would be way too easy to look up dates and look up things. There'd be too many, like when we're researching these episodes, we can go to Wikipedia, mm-hmm. we can go to IMDb, we can go to the Twilight Zone Vortex, we can go to the Onion AV Club. There's, you know, multiple sources. And we've found, even in researching for this podcast, where there's discrepancies in backstories or in dates or things like that. Usually it's only a matter of a couple clicks before you can kind of arrive at the truth of the matter and see which one's sourced properly and which ones corroborate and which one seems to be someone talking out there behind. But back then it was, you know, it was much more plausible that someone could get away with this sort of thing.
Yeah. This episode reminded me a lot of like EC Comics. Very straightforward, little twist, little horror element. And I actually really liked it. You know, it, for, again, it didn't feel particularly super Twilight Zone-y. Again, because like the whole mystical thing, like I said before, it kind of seems like a cheap MacGuffin. I did enjoy it. I liked Anne Blythe's performance a lot. I really enjoyed the way she handles the questions, and she kind of is playful with him, and you know, and even in some of the things where she's talking about, like, you know, oh, I was really young, and you know, the artist painted me as he thought I would be, and something. I believe there's one thing about how she like was lied about her age or something with like one of her first movie roles, and it comes off fairly naturally. You know, it's not anything that seems like way.
I wonder
out there.
how you know, purposefully they were trying to channel Elizabeth Taylor for this, because this was just the year after her giant flop of Cleopatra came out, and she had started as a very young starlet. You know, she had done was it National Velvet. You know, she had been the young teenage star catapulted to leading lady. So I wonder if they were, you know, besides, they never actually come out and say Cleopatra, but it's strongly hinted. And I wonder if at the same time, like, they're never saying Liz Taylor, but they're really, really, really going for that kind of look and aesthetic and persona.
Yeah, she was really good. She had a lot of control over her tiny micro facial muscles. So when she's really turning it on and being over the top with him, she's doing all these very like animated kind of twitchy motions with her face, and that way when she makes the switch after he kind of leaves the room and she's just, you know, yelling at her daughter or whatever, just saying like, keep your mouth shut or basically I'm gonna kill you. it's a great there's a great duality. She does a good job, and it's kind of fun when he comes in as sort of this like, I'm this report. I don't know that he's an investigative reporter. He's an entertainment reporter, I guess. But, you know, he's supposed to be someone digging for the truth, and he's got his little pad of questions. But the minute she starts to kind of flirt with him and be like, oh, you must think I'm crazy, he's like, duh, not at all. I wanted to kiss you.
Right. And then at the end, another, you know, young, dumb, handsome guy comes in to be the next victim kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, immediately. That must be exhausting for her, because she just finished soaking up this other guy's life force, and then this new guy walks in.
Well, as I'm sure you know, Ken, in Hollywood, there's no shortage of young, dumb guys, right?
It's true. It's true.
Yeah, this is, I think the one thing that I would have liked, and again, it, you know, compressed storytelling, whatever, it would have felt a little bit more interesting had Jordan Herrick done his own research rather than just call the editor. Again, I feel like it was just kind of like a lazy way of like getting that information out immediately, but a minor quibble for what otherwise I think is a pretty enjoyable episode.
Right. Yeah. Had this been an hour episode, it would have been him going back to the files and pulling out the photograph and comparing the photograph.
And they would have drawn out the relationship, so it wouldn't have just been like,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She turns into a cheetah. Other animals as well.
Yeah, there's a folk song in the middle.
Yeah.
Well, at least if the Egyptian was turning into an African cat, you'd feel it was a little more on the nose, you know?
Fun fact, her swimming pool...
Yep.
Same swimming pool as the Bewitching pool.
Ooh.
Oh, is it?
So is that like Rod Serling's swimming pool?
It was just the like, go-to swimming pool that they had for the location scout. Just knew we need a fancy swimming pool.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, not much to say about it. It's pretty straightforward. But you know, like I said, it feels very Tales from the Crypty.
I was curious why her daughter would have such a strong, like, Eastern European or Western, I don't know. Was she German? Was she supposed to be?
Well, actress is actually Austrian.
Austrian?
She was married to Peter Lorre for a while and was responsible for helping him launch his career.
Mm.
But I guess the idea is that, you know, this woman has been moving from, you know, ancient Egypt around, so probably
right.
Hooked up with some, you know, German, Austrian, whatever at some point.
Yeah. It's weird. So you just wonder a little bit about that relationship. Like, was right. The daughter for a while kind of like being her Renfield, but then stopped.
Got tired of it.
Got tired of it. And
well, she does get a moment at the end where she is almost jealous, you know, seeing her stay ageless while you yourself yellow and wither and die kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, again, some more kind of unexplored potential there.
Mm-hmm.
Episode should have been narrated by her.
Yeah.
Yes. I am so old now. My bitch of a mother is still young. How I despise her.
My mother, the ageless whore.
Now there's a 60s TV series that was never made. That sounds like a lighthearted sitcom romp. My mother, the ageless whore.
That's when some woman walks by and says, "Hey, I notice you got a lot of ageless whore flowers growing in your garden here."
For fun.
So we seem to be in agreement that Twilight Zone was not necessarily at its best when doing straight up magic.
I don't know. It doesn't have that spark that the best of the Twilight Zone episodes have. And maybe it's unfair to blame it on, you know, the idea of just magic, but it just seems to be kind of a prosaic explanation for weird stuff happening. And like I said, it feels a little more juvenile to say, like, oh, it's magic, you know, rather than something more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you could file these more under how Rod Serling always talked about. He was very concerned with the show being entertaining for everybody.
Yeah.
So trying to vary up the little subgenres and go into those more fantastic, whimsical territory every now and then. Mm-hmm. Definitely not in their wheelhouse, but can't blame them for trying.
And still watchable, these. You know,
they weren't horrible episodes, but they weren't great episodes.
I would skip Still Valley.
Yeah,
that one was just kind of a dud for me. But
you got to tune in to Jess Bell for Goth Farm Girl and Francis.
Yeah, and ladies, that don't discount that stud Billy Ben.
Gee, any clever catchphrases this weekend?
Oh, no, I have not been... listen, I just watched these episodes today, so full disclosure.
We prepare extensively for this podcast. For you,
I am usually much better than I have been recently, but...
You've been a busy guy, though.
I've been a busy boy, so yes. Hence why we might be taking a little soundsight mind hiatus.
Mm-hmm. Life does get in the way. But if, you know, we're going to keep the Instagram and Facebook posts coming. And if, you know, you have episodes you'd like us to do or anything, any trivia or insights you'd like to point out, anything... you'd like to tell us about the appeal of Billy Ben, perhaps?
A pointed defense of missing. The magical perspective in Rod Serling's universe.
Yeah. Well, definitely check us out on Facebook at SSM Podcast or Instagram at SSM Podcast. And, you know, subscribe on iTunes, listen on Stitcher, Podbean, or ssmpodcast.wordpress.com.
Mm-hmm. And the marathon's coming up pretty soon. It is. So that's always a fun time.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have to do something for the marathon.
Mm-hmm.
We'll live podcast the entire marathon.
The whole thing.
We'll just hook ourselves up to catheters so we can just sit there and watch and not leave for 1 second.
Our kids can say, "Mommy, what's Daddy doing?"
Like, Daddy is gone bye-bye.
All right, well.
All right, there.
Since we're now talking about neglecting our children, I guess that's a good time to end it.
There you go.
Thanks for listening.
All right, until next time.
Cold pop!